You're listening to Food Integrity Now with your host, Carol Grevet.
Hello and welcome to Food Integrity Now. I'm Carol Grevet. I'm your host today. At Food Integrity Now, we envision a healthy, sustainable world, a world where our food is free of GMOs and harmful chemicals. If you share this vision, go to our website and join us. Our website is foodintegritynow.org, and you can also find us on Facebook at Food Integrity Now and on Twitter, and we also have a YouTube channel. We appreciate you listening today. My guest today is E. Vagelos Valiantos. E.G. earned a B.A. in history from the University of Illinois and a doctorate in history from the University of Wisconsin. He also did postdoctoral studies in the history of science at Harvard. He worked for 2 years on Capitol Hill and for 25 years for the U.S. EPA. Today, we're going to be speaking with him about one of his recent books, Poison Spring, The Secret History of Pollution and the EPA. And we're going to be discussing how the EPA has betrayed its mission, which is posted on their website, to protect human health and the environment. E.G., welcome to Food Integrity Now.
Thank you very much.
You were employed by the EPA for 25 years, retiring in 2004. For most of that time, you worked for the Office of the Pesticide Programs, which is the largest organization in the EPA. When did you first become aware of some of the problems with the agency?
It took me no more than 6 months to a year to really figure out that there was something quite serious. But in the first year, I was fortunate. I worked with a wonderful biologist, and he and I and a team of other scientists were preparing to help the agency to ask the right questions when it came to the data that chemical companies give to the agency for their products to be approved or not approved. But after about a year, I changed positions and I joined a program that they call it Farm Workers Protection Program. And during that experience, I went to a seminar in North Carolina and I heard a number of experts speak about farm workers and speak about pesticides and speak about the exposure of these human beings to these chemicals. Let me back off for a second that before I joined EPA, I knew very little about pesticides. I mean, I had some vague idea that farmers used these sprays, but never did I think that these chemicals would be so extremely toxic. At any rate, at the seminar in North Carolina, we heard from toxicologists, biologists, ecologists, all sorts of people that care about human health. And when I got back, and I was so disturbed by what I learned during that week of intensive that I wrote a number of memos to my immediate supervisor, who was a woman deputy director of the division I used to work. And I explained to her that this was really inappropriate for the EPA to stand by while these people were really getting exposed to some very bad stuff. I mean, we are talking about chemicals that affect the central nervous system, the brain, behavior, learning, and so on. And I described to her in what I meant. I never got any response to my emails, to my memoranda. Pardon?
She just ignored your memo?
She simply never responded to the questions I was raising in the memos. And the questions I raised was that EPA ought to be very involved in prohibiting, in fact, banning many of these chemicals that the farmers use, especially in grape production and other crops that the farmers would use their hands to touch the leaves of the tree or the plant, and therefore the exposure would come not just merely breathing the air, but also touching. So the chemical would get on their skin and possibly their hands, they would eat. And by the way, these farm workers were mostly non-Americans, imported from Mexico, and they spoke probably no English, so they could not say that they could read the instructions as to what to do and what not to do. So I described all this, but then never any response. So after that, I figured that there was something terribly wrong with EPA. And then I began to express these doubts to my colleagues when we used to have lunch together. And they, in turn, began to talk about their own particular problems in other dimensions of regulation. And slowly they would bring to me all sorts of memos and letters and emails and eventually and briefings. And slowly I built a small library. And I said, why? I'm not the only one. And certainly I was not the only one who found problems. And it's from that information, those lengthy exchanges and interviews and discussions that went on for over 20 years, that I eventually wrote this book.
Yeah. Well, you say in the book, since lab tests are so critical to protecting our health and the environment, you'd think that they would be used widely to help monitor the some 80,000 synthetic chemicals in common use today, and that that could be nothing further from the truth. Can you explain that statement?
Yeah, most of the chemicals, they have not really been tested, and they have not been tested because, regrettably, the very people who manufacture the chemicals, that is the manufacturers and sometimes the polluters, had something to do with the writing of the original law, the law that regulates pesticides, and in fact, the law that regulates water, air, whatever. The polluters or the major factors had something to do with drafting of the law. So they created the law in such a technical way that there are tremendous loopholes. And therefore, for instance, the greatest loophole is that, that says that the person who comes to the agency to have something approved, he or she can actually test the chemical himself or pay somebody to do it. And then what they have to do is simply send the, a report to EPA. And EPA does nothing else but look at those reports.
Well, so they look at the report, and then, but they don't do their own test.
No. EPA rarely tests anything. no other government agency. I mean, there's the CDC, the Center for Disease Control. Sometimes they do testing, but in general, speaking in general, it's the industry that the law says they ought to test their chemicals, and then this is, in fact, I consider to be the greatest handicap in actually providing environmental protection in this country. The fact that we allow an industry with a tremendously bad record to go ahead and do the testing and then provide the government with reports, which may be doubtful, problematic, sometimes fraudulent, and so on. And you notice in the book I have a whole chapter that discusses the early history of this fraudulent business in science.
It's interesting because I think a lot of people believe that the EPA and the FDA and the USDA, that the extent of the corruption in those agencies is fairly recent. But it's not, is it?
No, it's not. I mean, the greatest fraud in U.S. history that is related to science and human health, this friend of mine, Adrian Gross, discovered it accidentally in 1976. And the laboratory that he discovered that was doing all these fraudulent studies had been in business for 25 years before 1976. So this was the 50s and the 60s primarily and the early 70s. And he, as he was telling me, and I mean, this man, Adrian Gross, he and I were in the same agency for several years. Our offices were next to each other. And I had the opportunity to be close to him for about 10 years, talking to him almost daily, and he gave me everything he wrote. So I came to know him very, very well. He was a very honorable, and not only an honorable human being, but a great scientist. He was born in Israel, or what it used to be, Palestine, and then he went to Canada. He went to the United States. He got to PhDs in pathology, and he was a kind of a toxicologist, pathologist. And he had spent 20 years of his life in the Federal Drug Administration before he joined EPA. And he discovered this fraud accidentally, and I say accidentally because it's exactly how you put it. Once he was inspecting one of this laboratory, and they gave him a piece of paper that had neat lines of written in with a pencil, all the numbers next to each other, very clean. And he said to me, the moment I saw the paper, I knew there was something wrong. He said, this raw data, they call this raw data in the laboratory, people are very, not intentionally careless, but in a laboratory, you kind of be very neat, right, and very close, clearly. So after that initial suspicion led him to bring a couple of his colleague inspectors, and they made an unannounced inspection of that laboratory, and they found out that it was just in samples. The people in the laboratory were, when they were doing a study, and they discovered one of the animals, for instance, had a growth or had a cancer, they simply replaced the animal with another animal, caring not in the least about the effects that this would have on the reliability of the study. They made up data. I mean, if it was a 24-month study, they did it in 10 months. And then the remaining of the months, they made the numbers up. And that kind of fraud. So when he came up with this in 1976, the EPA almost became paralyzed. They didn't know what to do. The agency was about 5 years old. And the industry was watching. So it was a horrible situation. What to do? Because that laboratory was so large that they had done almost 40% of all the tests for the whole country, and the tests related to drugs, not just pesticides, to drugs, to other chemicals. And they tested for local governments, for state governments, for the federal government, and of course for the whole chemical industry. And some of the largest selling chemicals to this very day came out of that legacy.
Wow. And he actually became somewhat of a whistleblower, didn't he?
Yeah, he eventually became a whistleblower because he tried to do good and they punished him for it. I mean, the same thing that happened to me. At any rate, in his case, they brought him in 1979, the year I also joined EPA. And they made him branch chief for toxicology, which he had about 100 people working for him. And he tried to educate them about the proper way of examining the information from coming out of the industry. And what he discovered was that within that branch, there were toxicologists that they were not doing an honorable work. That is, if you had several volumes of data that you had to go page by page by page to examine, they went straight to the conclusion written by the polluters, that is, and they lifted that conclusion word for word, and they made it EPA's conclusion. They call it cut and paste science.
Right. I saw that he called it the cut and paste reviews of the studies, which were basically conducted by the chemical companies.
Right.
And there's a quote in here. It says from him, he says, "Now I walk the halls, and once they see me, they cease their discussion and look at the ceiling. Now I say there are also dangerous people who threaten public health as well as pesticide companies do."
Yes, absolutely correct. He ordered them, of course, to resist and to stop this practice. And, of course, the moment that he did that, within a year, they pushed him off his job. They gave him an empty room, a computer, and never asked him to do anything again for EPA. And the man died in 1992. So that's the price you pay once you blow the whistle. Or once they call you, as they call me, they say, "You're no longer a team player." Well, the moment you ask critical questions and you say, "This is dangerous, and therefore we need to do something different, ban the chemical, replace it, do something to protect the environment and people in particular," they say, you're not a team player. And then, of course, they cut you off from any meaningful assignments. You just find your own way.
So you had to find your own way.
That's correct, yeah. I mean, I kept myself busy by reading and writing and by talking to congressional staff. But regrettably, the congressional staff, they didn't really pay much attention either, despite the fact that we had times that most of the House was Democratic, and I used to usually focus on the Democratic stuff. They promised to do things like hearings, but they never followed up. And that's really one of the greatest regrets of all the situations, that there is tremendous talent in the federal government. For instance, each congressman has his own staff, her own staff. They have a Congressional Research Service that has hundreds of very technically competent people in all professions. Then the committees and the subcommittees have investigative powers. They can seek assistance from any university in the country, from the government itself. They have money, they have investigators, and yet they have never followed up on this this very, very, very serious crisis that we all face for decades, not years, decades. And this is what I'm trying to say in the book. This is something very fundamental. I mean, we are supposed to protect our own health and the environment. If we fail to do that, then how do you expect any of us to actually worry about global warming or any other calamity?
Right.
So I said, we need to start with this and fix this because it's easily fixable.
Okay, we're going to talk about the fix, how it's easily fixable toward the end, but I want to discuss a few more things. In 1970, that's when the EPA was formed, right?
Yeah, December 1970, yeah.
Most of the scientists that came to the EPA came from the USDA, 80% of them. Why do you think this was a problem?
It was a problem because USDA has been in operation for 150 years, and therefore the influence of the industry on USDA has been tremendous for decades. I mean, EPA is a small potato compared to USDA. USDA has 150,000 or so employees, has been there for a century and a half. EPA has been only for 40 years, has only 18,000 people. So at any rate, when they created EPA, and they created EPA, by the way, because these big agencies like USDA had failed so miserably that you have the tragedy of rivers catching fire because of pollution, contamination of food and everything else. So they thought at least if they created an agency that would focus on protecting our health, it would be the best answer. And of course it was. EPA, despite my criticism, I think is still the greatest political innovation of the 20th century. We need the central agency to protect us. At any rate, to come back to your question, USDA had tremendous connections with the agribusiness industry, with fertilizer companies, with pesticide companies, and therefore the people that came from USDA, they were already very much in the know with this regulated industries. And therefore, they brought with them not just their talent, but also the corruption that they already had while serving USDA. And that's the problem.
Yeah. Well, you talk in the book about agriculture and pesticide use, and you quote Paul Ehrlich, who's a professor of biological science at Stanford University. And he said, when he was talking about pesticides, he said, an ideal product, like heroin, they promise paradise and deliver addiction. What do you think he meant by that?
He's absolutely correct. I mean, first of all, Paul Ehrlich has been dealing with these questions for 50 years. So he knows quite a bit more than I do and anybody else for that matter. And he knows that just like a person can be addicted to coffee, to wine or whatever, same thing in the farmers. They look at the problem, let's say an insect infestation, and their mind runs immediately, how do we kill all these insects? And the chemical industry has said, hey, we have an answer for your question. Here it is. You dump or you spray this chemical, and you see. And of course, he does it, and he sees everything is dead. But then he keeps doing it. And the more pesticides they use, the more the insects become immune to these chemicals. And therefore, the farmers indirectly create infestations because they don't really spray when it's really necessary. They spray, how do they say, prophylactically. They try to protect their crops by spraying, let's say, every 2 weeks, every month. Mm-hmm. But then, of course, the natural system does not work like that. You kill one thing and you create another big problem, and especially with these chemicals. They're really very toxic.
The dosage, frequent dosage, goes higher and higher. And so there's just more toxins in the soil, not only on the plants, but in the soil and the water, and it just trickles on down.
That's correct. And eventually it gets to us, and it gets to us through the food we eat, through the air we breathe, and the water we drink.
Yeah.
Well, you know, there's something that people rarely have heard, that if you spray, say, a gallon, only 0.1% of that gallon will ever get to what you're really trying to kill. 99.9% will become gas. It volatilizes, it becomes gas, and then it moves 5 miles, 10 miles, 20 miles, and then drops down with rain, with fog, with snow, with hail. So these things are very dangerous, I mean, because they just don't recognize any boundaries. So they move away. So if you spray in the countryside, but you live 20 miles away in the city, you're going to be sprayed as well. There's the so-called drift. The drift can go several miles. It can go far further than that. And so this is the problem. I mean, some of these pollutants, they become global pollutants. So you have people living in the North Pole, and they, if you look at their fatty tissue, you find in the fatty tissues more contaminants than the people who live in New York City. So this is why you explain that. That is, the chemicals become airborne, and they transfer and they move around the earth, and they drop.
And this becomes a huge problem too for the organic farmer.
Absolutely. I mean, that's correct. Yeah. I mean, the organic farmer is trying to produce something honestly, without using these synthetic toxins. And yet, as we said, because of drift, unfortunately, some of the stuff of the conventional farmer will drift and land on organic food. So, in a sense, we undermine the very idea of regeneration. And, you know, and then you have in addition to that, you have the genetically engineered food. The farmer who used this genetically engineered stuff, also sometimes the plant itself, it moves by the wind, that is the seed, and then lands on an organic farmer, and they might put this organic farmer out of business if the seed moves from one point A to point B. So this is a very precarious system, which is why I think we need to heed people like Rachel Carson and other great biologists who have warned us not to how to put it, to get away from this commitment or this almost illness to rely on these synthetic chemicals to grow our food.
Yeah. It seems like we should have learned something from Agent Orange. You know, most everybody has heard of the Agent Orange, which was used as a defoliant in the Vietnam War. And it was sprayed in the jungles there on some 4.5 million acres, which basically made that land a toxic dump. And also, the health effects were 50 million Vietnamese were exposed to the chemical and 400,000 died or were maimed, and our U.S. soldiers, too, experienced so many issues and are still experiencing issues of cancer and health issues, mental health issues. And it's interesting because this compound is a 50-50 mixture, is my understanding, of two chemicals, 2,4-D and 2,4-5-T. And now Dow Chemicals is working on getting approval of their GMO corn and soy that is resistant to this 2,4-D chemical, which, you know, it was part of the ingredient in Agent Orange, and they're trying to get that approved. It's crazy.
It's crazy because, you know, these chemicals, the Agent Orange compounds, they were also contaminated with this extremely toxic chemical or rather a compound, several compounds that are known as dioxins.
Right.
And these dioxins, you know, the government itself admitted that they constitute the most toxic molecule ever created by human beings. And we are talking about the findings and research of the late 70s, early 70s. And during that time, the Forest Service and timber companies, of course, used these two weeds. These are, they kill plant life. They use them all over the country extensively. And there's a really interesting story to be told from Oregon when the timber companies were spraying 2,4,5-T in a community that was very close to a number of women that were getting pregnant, but they never had a full-term baby because the chemical, the dioxin, EPA discovered, was right in a creek very close to the community. And because of the association of that dioxin and the women having tremendous medical problems, that when EPA decided to go ahead and ban 2,4,5-T. And the knowledge, but the knowledge, of course, EPA never disseminated widely, so that the Veterans Administration, when the soldiers were coming back from Vietnam and they sought compensation, they told them, hey, look, there's no problem. We don't know anything about dioxide. Dioxide doesn't do much good harm to you. And EPA, of course, knew about it because they had discovered the dioxin in Oregon, close to these women. And they kept the information secret quite a bit, and it took up down to 1983 to ban 2,4,5-T. So it's a kind of all these chemicals and what has happened, they create a kind of a scientific and moral dilemmas that we as a civilized society, we should never have to address, to face, so to speak.
And DDT was a dioxin too, correct?
As far as I know, no.
DDT is not a dioxin? Okay.
No, DDT is an organochlorine. That is a chemical that is related to chlorine. The stuff that it was a war gas during World War I, if you can believe it. The Allies and the Germans, they kill each other by the thousands by using chlorine gas, and that wiped out, I don't know, how many young men in World War I. And then after the war was over, then the chemical industry was smart enough to take advantage of that, and they began to create pesticides out of chlorine and out of petroleum. That's why we call some of these chemicals petrochemicals.
Okay.
They come out of petroleum. And chlorinated hydrocarbons, they are related directly to chlorine, to the chlorine molecule. And so there is a chemical warfare dimension to all these pesticides, something that, of course, the industry never admits, and, of course, neither does the government. But it's a fact. It's kind of a history of these chemicals go straight to warfare. And regrettably, we manipulate science and do all sorts of illegal and unethical things in order to allow these chemicals to have the kind of safe-like appearance to use in our agriculture and in our lawns, and to expose every human being, including little babies.
Yeah. Well, you know, and DDT was banned in, 1972?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And I think people are still having effects from this chemical. And when I interviewed Dr. Don Huber in April, I asked him, I was talking about DDT and glyphosate, which is the active ingredient in Roundup, and he said that DDT is a pittance toxicity-wise compared to glyphosate.
Wow, that's extraordinary, because DDT was indeed very toxic, and it killed all sorts of creatures.
Well, as many of you may know or may not know, that Dr. Huber is a retired colonel, and he also had much experience in chemical warfare, as well as...
I know that, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
And then he taught at Purdue plant pathology. But so let's talk about glyphosate for a minute. You say in the book that Monsanto and government authorities have known about the toxic effects of glyphosate since the 80s, and both the industry and the public have been kept in the dark.
Obviously, I must cite Don Huber or other authorities about this.
Yeah.
But it's like the DDT. I mean, it was there for decades before they finally decided to get rid of it. And by the way, the interesting thing is about DDT, it was banned by a Republican governor, a Republican president, Richard Nixon, and a Republican head of the EPA, William Rockerhaus. They said enough is enough. And Clinton, Nixon, because of the Vietnam War and because of what happened with Watergate, he has gotten a very bad reputation and so on. But when it comes to environmental protection, I respect the guy. He created the EPA and he did this. And they were the first in the country that began to lead the country into a kind of a right path. But unfortunately, after the banning of DDT, the industry got together and they said, we cannot allow EPA to continue to do this. So they have been pressuring EPA to the point that they actually more or less control it indirectly.
Yeah, well, I think glyphosate is a huge problem. And And recently, the EPA increased the allowable limits in our food crops from 200 parts per million to 6,000 parts per million. What is that, a 3,000% increase? I mean, that's crazy. So they've increased that, and studies have shown that much smaller amounts, parts per million, you know, it's been found in urine, in breast milk, in the soil, in our gut bacteria. And I think it is one of the biggest problems chemical-wise that we're facing right now.
Well, it is, because if nothing else, because it is the most popular herbicide on earth. And
right.
They use it extensively in the hundreds of millions of pounds of active ingredients. And it gets into everything. And, of course, nature is reacting. There are all sorts of super weeds that you cannot kill. And that causes problems to farmers. It causes problems to a lot of people, because they have to double the amount of chemical to kill the weed and so on. And as you noticed, as you said, this stuff is found even in the mother's milk. And I'm telling anybody I speak to, a mother who's talking about that, I said, you are the solution. You and other women like you have to get together to do something about it, to stop it. And you have to tell your government, you have to tell your politicians that this is completely intolerable for you to have poison in your milk that you're going to try to give to your own baby.
Yeah, and I agree with you.
That is a crime, I think.
It is a crime, and, you know, there's wonderful people out there that are just fighting this, like Zen Honeycutt, Moms Across America. They recently got an audience with the EPA because glyphosate, I think it's coming up for renewal. They do that every so often, and they wanted to present some of the independent tests to the EPA to allow the EPA to take a look at this, and I just really applaud their efforts. I'm not terribly hopeful that anything is going to be done in a positive manner with the EPA.
Yeah, I no longer I say I'm pessimistic or optimistic, but what I do say is this. It's their life, and they have to fight for it. After all, it has taken 70 years or so to come to the predicament that we are facing today, and we have come to the point where we are for a number of historical reasons. But one of them is that we are usually apathetic, and we get involved with our own private little business, and we never care about anything else.
Right.
Removed us from the natural world by putting us into cities, into apartments, into homes, far away from where the food is raised. They have allowed the larger farmers to take over the land. They have good reason for the small farmers. And because of all that, I mean, it's like a private domain. You go into rural America right now and you don't see anything except flat lands that go as far as the eye can see. No houses, you see, no more communities. I have gone into the Great Valley here, the main valley here in California, and I don't see anything. You know, it's just a lonely, toxic landscape that has been taken over by very few farmers, mega farmers, people that now own 4,000, 5,000, 10,000 acres of land, and they grow one crop, and they, of course, drench that crop with the chemicals that we're talking about.
Yeah, it's a huge problem. And speaking of in California, let's talk about the honeybees. That is also another issue, that our honeybees are dying. And I think you said that 30 to 60% of the honeybees in the California area are dying prematurely. And this large part is due from the chemicals that are being sprayed. So let's talk about neonicotinoids. A lot of people have heard that word just because it's associated with colony collapse disorder.
The issue of the honeybees was one of the first that really, really got me very upset when I was at EPA. I discovered about that through talking to my ecology friends, and they trusted me, and they gave me to read the correspondence they had with their supervisors and also with the industry. And it turns out that as early as 1974, EPA had been convinced to allow the use of neurotoxins put in tiny microcapsules to spray over the field so that the honeybee would not be able to recognize what she was picking up, because the capsules were as large as a fragment or tiny particle of pollen. And she was coming loaded to her hive, and of course the gas, the neurotoxins would be spread and the whole hive would die. And this is 1974, so these ecologists were extremely upset, and they were writing letters to their supervisors telling them, let's put a moratorium, because we see a lot of death going on throughout the country. But the supervisors, of course, they had their ears glued to the White House and to Congress, and they said, no way. So they expanded the use of this kind of very toxic chemicals. And pretty soon, not only corn, but soybeans and alfalfa and so on, other crops, had been allowed to be sprayed by these very toxic compounds. So you have more and more honeybees dying. So now what you have with neonicotinoids right now is simply the continuation of the old system of using neurotoxins to kill this very useful, very beautiful insect.
Yeah. I mean, and birds and butterflies. And,
all the yeah. stuff that breathes. I mean, you can kill anything with these neurotoxins because they are the same things that kill human beings by asphyxiation. They do the same thing to a honeybee or to a bird. And the idea that you can do that, to me, is unconscionable. And this is why I said, when you allow a chemical company to do its own testing, you are in trouble. But then, of course, all this is thought out clearly because they said, look, how can we take chemicals that are related to chemical warfare agents and allow them in our agriculture? So we have to create a system that has the appearance of human safety and protection. And they did that magnificently. They created the EPA. The EPA has the appearance of science. They have hundreds of scientists working for this. And I'm not accusing scientists right now. What I'm saying is they are there as a kind of like a lipstick, but the real policy decisions are not made by these men and women with PhDs. The real policy decision is done by the political appointees of the president within the EPA. And they, of course, are glued to the industry who's funded them to get reelected.
Yeah.
So that's the political connection. This is the corruption that is paralyzing the EPA. So that EPA, we need EPA, but we need to have a real EPA as it was in 1970, and 71, and 72, an agency that will actually do a good job in protecting our health and the environment. And as it is right now, regrettably, that place is not what it used to be.
Unfortunately, greed, in my opinion, one of the biggest issues is people can be bought. Scientists can be bought. Politicians they're bought. I mean, it's all based in greed.
Greed, yeah, certainly greed is, but it's irresponsible. I mean, that's why we have laws.
Mm-hmm.
Laws should not be making favors to the people with money or the people with power. If we don't do that, then we become a lawless society. And then everybody's on his own or her own. Then you have to buy a gun to protect yourself. Now, that's why we have a law. Laws ought to be good for me and you and anybody else. And therefore, I mean, we protect our own health. After all, these people with big power and money, they also face the same dilemma. After all, they eat the same poison food. They breathe the same air. They're not going to be enclosed in a palace and create a pure environment for themselves.
Yeah, yeah. I always wonder about that. Even with like the GMOs and these biotech companies creating these, and I'm thinking it's going to affect them too.
Yeah, and it is. I mean, death rate in this country is horrendous. One out of three women is dying of cancer right now, and one out of two men. So how more do you want to go? You want to go, everyone is dying of cancer? I mean, then you're going to say, oh my God, we have done a mistake. Let's reverse it. So this is why the public saying 1 ounce of prevention is an hour, whatever. We need to prevent all this from taking place. We know how to raise food with all these chemicals.
Okay, so let's talk about solutions. The conclusion in your book is entitled Better Living in a Healthier Natural World Through Small Family Farms. Let's discuss some of these solutions that could change the way we are doing things and perhaps help clean up the soil and the environment from all these toxic chemicals.
I mean, the idea of moving into industrialized mega farms is an idea of the 19th century when everybody was caught in this fever of industrializing. The machines were new and everybody fell in love with the machines and so on. And I mean, I'm not against machines. I'm not against science. I'm not against technology. But because of that exuberance, they make a lot of mistakes. First of all, they assume that the larger, the better, the larger, the more productions, and so on. All that is completely nonsense. The small farmer is more productive per acre than anybody on earth. So we need to return back to the small-scale farmer. The small-scale farmer, even if this person uses some of these chemicals, they use less, and they use less variety of those chemicals. So if you have to choose between eating an onion from a 50-acre onion farmer to a 5-acre, the person that eats the onion from the 5-acre is safer. So that's theory number one. In other words, you get good production of food, healthier production of food by the small farmer. And then you inhabit the land. You populate the rural America. Rural America, as I said, by now is almost like an alien territory. So we need to repopulate the country, bring thousands, in fact, millions of small farmers, and stop the subsidizing of these larger farmers. As we speak right now, about $20 billion per year go to the guys that are over 200, 300-acre farmers. Mm-hmm. So we need to reverse all that. Take that money and give it to these very small family farmers. We need to do what the administration of Lincoln and the administration of other presidents before the 50s, they did. That is, they support the small family farmers.
Yeah.
Number two, we need to order the land-grant universities to stop assisting the larger farmers with industrialization and chemicals. We are funding those universities, and yet they have completely ripped apart their mission statement. They are right now helping the likes of Monsanto. I want them to go and use their ingenuity and talent to help the organic farmers and the farmers who are tiny, 5 acres, 10 acres, 20 acres. That's what we should do as a national policy. And if we do that, we're going to see all these chemicals slowly disappear because they're not really useful. The organic farmers produce perfect food without a drop of these synthetic chemicals.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but even if an emergency, we should keep some of these chemicals in an emergency and we can use them wisely. Once I brought David Pimentel, a distinguished professor of entomology from Cornell. I brought him to the EPA, and he gave a lecture, and I asked a question, and he said, look, we need to have the farmers get prescription from experts as to why and when to use certain synthetic chemical. And we can do that, rather than just simply sell the stuff, and give it to them, and they can do anything they please. So these are the steps. And then, personally, we all should begin to eat organic food. Mm-hmm. I know it's slightly more expensive than conventional food, but if we do that, our money goes to the people who really are going to save us out of this predicament, these organic farmers. And in addition to that, we do a huge favor to ourselves by eating organic food. We don't need sludge, we don't need radiation, we don't need pesticides, we don't need genetically engineered food, genetically engineered stuff. So we have that tiny little industry, organic farming, which is the future. Therefore, we should make it the present as well as the future. That's what we should do. And I think that's fundamentally the solution. And then when it comes to EPA, we should redesign the place and forbid by law any lobbies from the industry, from the White House and Congress to even approach them. They should work in isolation by themselves. And the EPA administrator ought to appoint his own deputies rather than the president, so that there should be no political appointee within the EPA. So these scientists know that their knowledge will be actually to protect us rather than to favor financially a few chemical companies and large farmers.
Wow, well, those are some great solutions, and you know, we can only hope that some of this can be implemented, and I agree with you. particularly on supporting the small organic farmers. Go to your local farmers market and get to know some of the farmers in your area and support them.
Exactly. Exactly. We can convince our school boards, for instance, instead of feeding the kids conventional food, they should buy organic food. Just think of what would happen if all the school boards in the whole country suddenly they began to feed organic food to all these millions of children.
Oh, wouldn't that be amazing? I did a project recently where I went to a school and I did a little talk with the kids about how they're being targeted by these big corporations and their food with their sugar-laden food. And then we went to the grocery store and I had them find ingredients. And they found that some of their favorite products had these ingredients that I had now made them aware of that were big problems and causing health issues and stuff. So and these kids got really excited about it and we're talking about, oh, we need organic food in our school. So I think if we educate our children too, they're the ones that are going to demand, and the mothers demand better quality food.
Correct. And then there's another way to help is to convince churches. After all, this is a tremendously moral problem. You know, disease, we cause disease to ourselves and we are threatening the very survival of the planet. So people who are Christian or whatever religion they may be, they want to preserve creation, correct? I would hope.
Mm-hmm.
If they do, then why don't they actually begin to preach about it? It's okay to preach in the Bible business, fine, but then why don't you preach something even more important, that is the survival of the natural world, the survival of the birds, the survival of the honeybees, and therefore our own well-being, indirectly and directly linked to all that. So there are tremendous ways of solving the problem. We don't need to be pessimistic, but we need to be effective and political and active.
Right, and that key word, I think, is active, too, and because I really believe that every individual can make a difference, and collectively, we can make a huge difference. So thank you, G, for being a guest on our show. The book is called Poison Spring, and you can buy this anywhere, Amazon, or do you have any other places you want to refer people to?
Barnes & Noble, the Amazon, all the big bookstores. And finally, allow me to make one last statement. I think your readers would do themselves a favor if they read this book. And forgive me for saying that. It's not for me. I wrote the book, but this is a great story of what the government does rather than what you think it does. And unless you have that knowledge, that information, you cannot even ask the right question.
Right.
So knowledge is power. And I provide in everybody who reads the book with some power and some confidence to do the things that are completely right for themselves and for the rest of us.
Yes, and I will tell you personally, I learn much, and a fascinating book, and you know, I will share this information with others as well. So thank you for our listeners, and we will be back in a couple of weeks with another great show. And as always, stay active and be informed. Thanks again.
My pleasure.